today we are looking at a very different matter, the question of nuclear weapons and 21st century threats, implications for safety and security. And this is again a very topical issue, particularly as I think we're going to soon be asked in our House and in the House of Commons to vote on the renewal of Trident. So this will be something we'll all be thinking about very carefully. We have two speakers. I'll introduce them both now and then I'll ask them to speak to us for about 20 minutes each. And after that, I'll open the floor to questions and comments. The first speaker today on my right will be Eric Schlosser. He's an American journalist and author, and he's best known for his investigative journalism, as in his books Fast Food Nation, Chew on This, and Reefer Madness. His work appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, The Nation, and Vanity Fair. His recent book, Command and Control, is about the effort to control nuclear weapons to prevent the launch of a thermonuclear weapon by accident, by mistake, or by any unauthorized means. That book, as I understand it, is shortly to be produced in documentary form. And I hope we'll be able to see that when it is available. I'm going to ask him to speak first, but I'll also introduce Des Brown, Lord Brown of Leyton, colleague of mine in the House of Lords, member of the British Labour Party, member of Parliament for Kilmarnock and Loudoun from 1997 to 2010. He held various roles in government. In 2006, he was appointed Secretary of State for Defence, and rather uniquely combined that for 4 years of being Secretary of State, 3 years of being Secretary of State, 1 year. I'm not surprised when you think. Secretary of State for Scotland as well. He went onto the back benches in 2008. He served on the first Joint Committee on National Security Strategy. And from October 2009 to March 2014, he was convener of a top-level group of parliamentarians for multilateral nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation. He has served as the Nuclear Threat Initiative's vice chairman, and in this role he helped shape their strategic direction, including long-term planning and international outreach. So I'll ask him to speak second. But I'm first of all going to ask Eric Schlosser to speak to us.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming out this morning to hear about such an enlightening and encouraging subject. I really do believe that we are facing two great existential threats at the moment. One of them is climate change, and the other is the threat of nuclear weapons. And yet climate change receives an extraordinary amount of attention, and the threat of nuclear weapons relatively little. I spent 6 years researching my book, Command and Control. I was looking at the effort of the United States government from the beginning of the atomic era until the present day to control its nuclear weapons. And by that I mean not through arms control, not through treaties, but the mechanisms by which we would ensure that these weapons could be used when they were sought to be used but could never be used inadvertently. One of the problems today is that the discourse about nuclear weapons focuses on them primarily as symbols. They're regarded as measures of national power, a symbol of great power status. Governments often seek to obtain them for that reason. And in my work, I've tried to look beyond the symbolism and regard these weapons for what they really are, which are machines, extremely effective and lethal machines. To put their effectiveness into some context, we are now, I think, very close to the fifth anniversary of the civil war in Syria, which has been a tragedy for non-combatants and civilians. About 500,000 Syrians, mainly civilians, have been killed over the past 5 years of a very brutal conflict. The detonation of a single nuclear weapon would kill that many civilians almost instantaneously. In the 6 years of conflict during the Second World War, an estimated 50 to 60 million people were killed, again, mainly civilians. The most recent estimates of a relatively low-level nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan using about 100 atomic weapons, not thermonuclear weapons, would cause perhaps a billion casualties in a relatively short period of time. So these are very lethal machines. And it's important to emphasize their mechanistic nature, because as machines invented by human beings, they are inherently imperfect and flawed. It's hard to think of any machine that we have ever invented that doesn't somehow go wrong. Even the most impressive and miraculous. The modern airliner is one of the safest means of transportation. And yet airliners vanish and sometimes are never discovered. It's a tragedy for the few hundred passengers and for the hundreds of relatives of those passengers, but that sort of technological failure has a limit. There was a Swiss Air flight in the 90s that vanished over the Atlantic, and it was very mysterious. And the cause of the accident was later traced to the in-flight entertainment system. There had been a short circuit in the wiring. And when the very ingenious engineers were designing that brilliant contraption, they never had imagined that a system designed to entertain the passengers would kill them. So these nuclear weapons are machines. They're the most dangerous machines ever invented. And it's impossible to conceive of any machine that we could make that would not contain inherently our own flaws. In looking at the history of the nuclear era, there's been an element of uncertainty about these machines literally from the very beginning. On the eve of the Trinity test in the desert of New Mexico in July of 1945, there was a real question about whether the detonation of the first nuclear device would set the Earth's atmosphere on fire and literally kill every living thing on Earth. Now, in the Manhattan Project, you had the gathering of the most brilliant physicists throughout the Western world. And there was a fair degree of confidence, based on their calculations, that detonating a nuclear device would not set the atmosphere on fire. But they really weren't sure until they did it. And there was a young physicist named Victor Weisskopf who had spent the previous year doing the mathematical calculations on whether the Earth's atmosphere would catch on fire. And when he saw the bright white flash and felt the heat on his face from miles away, Weisskopf, in that moment, was convinced that his calculations were wrong and that every living thing on Earth was about to die. Not long after that, we were testing the first deliverable thermonuclear weapon in the Bikini Atoll. And our calculations proved to be wrong once more. When they detonated this thermonuclear weapon, the blast got bigger and bigger. Once again, they were concerned that detonating a thermonuclear weapon might set the Earth's atmosphere on fire. They had spent another year or two doing the calculations. But as the detonation of this thermonuclear device got bigger and bigger, there was a concern that it might not stop. And I spoke to an American official who was there watching it, terrified, as the fireball got bigger and bigger. That blast, called the Bravo test, wound up being 3 times more powerful than all the calculations had estimated. And they were very concerned when they realized how powerful this one weapon could be. The sort of nuclear device detonated at the Bravo test detonated over the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., they soon calculated, would kill everyone in Washington, everyone in Baltimore, everyone in Philadelphia, half the population of New York City, with fatalities as far north as Boston. Just one of those devices. Not long after, Winston Churchill commissioned a study here in the United Kingdom to see what the impact of these thermonuclear devices might be in a war here. And the Strath report concluded that 10 of these devices, 10 hydrogen bombs, detonated on the west coast of Great Britain would essentially destroy this as a functioning society and would immediately kill one-third of the population. So these are very dangerous machines, and machines that I would argue from the very beginning were not entirely under our control. In the very beginning of the Cold War, in the late 1940s, when we had atomic bombs, not yet thermonuclear weapons, at the Pentagon, they tried to come up with their first nuclear war plan to figure out what would be an effective attack on the Soviet Union. And our first war plan involved 50 atomic bombs of the nature of the same sort that we used at Nagasaki against the Soviet Union. And then it was later calculated that 175 of those weapons would be effective at essentially destroying the Soviet Union as a functioning society. So by 1948, we planned to attack the Soviet Union with 175 atomic bombs. 20 years later, the United States had an arsenal of 32,000 nuclear weapons, a great many of them thermonuclear weapons like the kind used at the Bikini Atoll. And I spoke to former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara in trying to understand how is it that at one point we thought we only needed 50 to 175 relatively small nuclear weapons to win a nuclear exchange, and then we wound up with 32,000. And McNamara's explanation was, in the Cold War nuclear arms race, each step was perfectly logical at the time, and step by step by step led to a place of total madness. 32,000 nuclear weapons. At one point, the U.S. Army alone wanted 70,000 nuclear weapons that they planned to use on the battlefield. Now, the problem with having large numbers of nuclear weapons is you need to control them. It's a form of inventory control. You need to know where they all are and how they're being stored. But it's also a much more significant management issue, because during the Cold War, the United States wanted to make sure that its weapons were always reliable, they go off when you drop them or you fire them, and that they were always available for immediate use. At the same time, we wanted to design weapons that always could be used immediately. We wanted weapons that would never detonate by accident, that would never be stolen, that would never be sabotaged, that would never be used by unauthorized personnel. And one of the great challenges of a nuclear command and control system is the sort of mechanisms that guarantee always may be exactly the opposite of the mechanisms that guarantee never. A perfectly safe nuclear weapon is one that's completely disassembled and has a nuclear core miles away from the rest of the weapon. But that sort of perfectly safe weapon can't be used immediately. So throughout the Cold War, there were these trade-offs between always and never. And in my book, I chronicle again and again how the emphasis was always on always and how dangerous that proved to be. Because you not only have the machine that's the nuclear weapon, but that machine is connected to other machines. Communication systems, early warning systems, computer systems, and the potential for error is magnified. One of the central themes of my book is that human beings are ingenious at creating complex technical technological systems, but we're not as good at controlling them or knowing what to do about them when something goes wrong. So through Freedom of Information Act searches and through interviews with the people who are running our nuclear command and control system, in my book I go through a litany of nuclear accidents, of miscalculations, of technical errors that could have led to American cities being destroyed by America's own nuclear weapons. A great deal was written about the threat posed by Soviet weapons, but there was enormous secrecy around the danger simply of possessing these weapons. The official Pentagon list of broken arrows, of serious nuclear weapons accidents, has 32 of these events. Through the Freedom of Information Act, I got a document that listed more than 1,000. And that was just between 1950 and 1968. Since the book has come out, I was expecting to be attacked by members of our nuclear weapons establishment, and instead, I've had a series of people come forward and tell me about all sorts of accidents that aren't in the book, and I'm sure there are many, many others that are still heavily classified. So there is this huge challenge of managing these machines. In the book, I mention a phrase used by early software designers about how hard it is to control complex technological systems. And it's the Titanic effect. Basically, the safer you assume the system to be, the more dangerous it's becoming. There's a need for constant, constant vigilance. And I'd like to say that my book is really of only historical interest, but you only need to look at some of the problems the United States has had with its arsenal in the last decade. In 2007, we lost track of half a dozen powerful thermonuclear warheads for a day and a half. They were mistakenly loaded onto an airplane. They were flown across the United States. They were left on the plane unattended. Very easily could have been stolen. And the most disturbing thing was that nobody had been asked to sign for them when removing them from a bunker, and the pilot of the plane had no idea that there were half a dozen nuclear weapons on board. We can go through a litany of other problems that we've had. In 2010, 50 American intercontinental ballistic missiles suddenly went offline. What that meant is their launch crews could no longer communicate with the missiles for almost an hour. There was a concern that someone had hacked into the nuclear command and control system. The Air Force did an investigation and found that there had been a problem with a computer chip in a communications device. But it raised the real possibility that someone could hack into the nuclear command and control system and either dud all of our missiles or perhaps launch one of them. Now, that sounds like the plot of a terrible Hollywood film, but you only need to consider the case of Edward Snowden, who was a relatively low-level private contractor working for the NSA, who was able to get into their computer systems and gain the most top-secret information the United States had, information I believe that President Obama was probably unaware of. And the NSA, it just so happens, is responsible for the cryptographic equipment that controls our nuclear weapons. There's no evidence that Snowden got to that material. But, you know, there's the risk of a rogue foreign government trying to get into our nuclear command and control system. But there's also the risk of an insider attack. And it's a very real risk. So, in my book and in my work, I'm very critical of the United States and its management of its nuclear arsenal for the last 70 years. And yet I have to say with some patriotic pride, we invented this technology, we perfected it, we probably do as good a job as anyone in managing it. We've never had an accidental detonation of any of the 70,000 weapons that we've built. But if we've come this close repeatedly with our technological expertise, think about North Korea. Think about Russia. Think about other countries that are not being vigilant. I don't want to be apocalyptic about this. When you're talking about the risk of an accidental nuclear explosion or sabotage, we're talking about a very, very low probability event. Unfortunately, it will have very high consequences. When the computer system on an airliner fails and an airliner crashes, it's limited in its consequence. The accidental detonation of a single nuclear weapon could destroy a city. The unauthorized launch of intercontinental ballistic missiles could cause a nuclear war. And the fact is, very low probability events happen all the time. At the end of the documentary that we've just made, one of our foremost nuclear weapons designers talked about having designed our weapons so that in an accident there's only a 1 in a million chance that they'll detonate and you know, if something goes wrong. But if there's a 1 in a million odds, that means that it might happen 1 million years from now, or it could happen tomorrow. And I'm going to end on this this note, just talking about how low probability events occur, and you want them to be happy low probability events, not catastrophic and apocalyptic. In the United States, this year, we had a Powerball lottery. And the winning, this is in California, and the prize of the lottery was $1.5 billion. So a lot of people bought lottery tickets. The odds of winning that lottery were 1 in 300 million. And there was a lot of scoffing in the media about who would be so foolish as to buy one of those tickets when the odds were 1 in 300 million. Three different people at three different locations bought the winning ticket by picking the right numbers. So the odds of them winning were 1 in 300 million. Each one of them now has $500 million. So these things happen. And we need to remember that these weapons exist. Thousands of them, hidden away, out of sight, out of mind, ready to be used, or ready to go wrong. And they aren't just symbols. So, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. First of all, I'm delighted to be here and thank you all for turning out. I think a word of thanks to you, Michael, and Jacqueline and the Global Strategy Forum for facilitating this discussion and for the work that you've been doing. I heard yesterday over 10 years in this forum to give us a place here in London to have these kind of discussions. And part of my thesis is that, you know, the conversation that we are having this morning is a conversation that few, if any, parliamentarians will have on these issues. So this is of great benefit, I think, to our understanding of international relations and some of the greatest challenges of the world. So my first point is to set some kind of context for this discussion to a large degree. Eric has done so, but I have spent the last 3 days, or most of the last 3 days, in the company of former Secretary of Defence William Perry, who was in London at my invitation. And I've been listening to this utterly empathetic and intelligent man talk knowledgeably about nuclear weapons and the dangers that they pose for the world. And all who heard him must have been struck by his provocative, not to say frightening, outlook, which I summarise in the following sentence, that the possibility of nuclear catastrophe today is greater than it was during the Cold War. I ask you to think about that in this broader context. For those of you who have read Eric's exceptional piece of journalism, Command and Control, to think about it in the context of that amazing book. I mean, I think, I said this to Eric this morning and he was embarrassed by it, and I'm going to embarrass him again. I think he's done an amazing service to humanity by writing this book. It's an extraordinary piece of work. You know, and if anybody's got any association with the university, universities of the world should be in a race to give this man an actual PhD for what he's done. You know, not just an honorary PhD for what he's done. This is an amazing book, and he could talk for hours, and you would not get the sense of the importance of this document and the work that has gone into it. I mean, it explains in an accessible way utterly complex issues, which many people know a bit of, but very few people can have access to the explanation that he has given. So, you know, I spent best part of 3 days, and I'm going to spend the best part of today in his company, and it is not often that you get an opportunity to spend time with people who you think of as your heroes and they are becoming your friends, and certainly not at my time of life. So it's been an extraordinarily privileged week for me. And if you do want to see the actual documentary Command and Control, we have a copy of it, and we will be showing it this afternoon in the Macmillan room of Portcullis House, and Eric will be there and the director will be there, and we will have a conversation about it. So I ask you to think about that, about Bill Perry's words in that context. I also ask you to think about them in the following, and I'll just quickly go through what's going on in the world that you will know already, but cluster this in your mind. North Korea's bluster about nuclear weapons. You know, in the presentation apparently now of a miniaturised nuclear warhead, it may or may not be, you know, but depending on what side of this argument you're on, I speak to people, you know, who kind of look at me very knowingly and say, I cannot tell you what the answer is, but we are doing this, that and the next thing, you know, to give me the impression that they actually have a miniaturised warhead, and other people on the other side of the argument try to convince me of the opposite, but, you know, we know what's going on there. The increasingly irresponsible Russian rhetoric about nuclear weapons, and the tendency in the West, and at least, you know, there are some people in this room who have been present with me where I've had a recent discussion in which this has been going on. The tendency in the West for us to want to match the Russians' actual weapon for weapon, no matter how irresponsible we think that is and no matter how destabilising these weapons are, but there is a tendency in the West to want to do that at very high levels in our collective security. And also the willingness of some people to quickly dive into a conversation about actually starting to think about these weapons in their smaller forms as war-fighting weapons. We're back in that discussion. You know, and we condemn the Russians rightly, I think, for doing this, because you have to be responsible, and at least we learned this in the Cold War, that there was a level of responsibility for these weapons, but we're having to relearn it because we're losing the people who had that ability to do it, and we're rushing towards this kind of conversation. The fact that the doomsday clock is currently set at 3 minutes to midnight. Now, some people may dismiss this, but this is a collective of very thoughtful calculation. And it was last at 3 minutes to midnight in 1984, and it is only 1 minute away from its lowest ever point, which was 2 minutes to midnight in 1953. And my own organisation, Nuclear Threatenist, this publication in September of last year of the collective, the distillation of the collective views of the leading experts in the United States, Russia, Europe on nuclear weapons issues, of their view that the risk of nuclear use is rising 25 years. Why not? I keep saying 25 years. It's now 30 years after the end of the Cold War, nearly. Is rising instead of decreasing, when only 10 years ago we were all confident that we were on an inexorable path of moving towards collective disarmament. And we were at one stage 20 minutes away from ridding the world of these nuclear weapons. Add to all of that the fact that all of the nuclear armed states in the world, all of the nuclear armed states in the world, are either have or are intending to modernise their nuclear weapons. And the important thing about this is that collectively we are committing future generations to a dependency for their strategic security on a weapon system and the control of that weapon system that we perfected for the middle of the 20th century in a different world altogether. And the great anomaly of this is that most of the people who are doing this are actually not going to be living in those 50 years that we are committing these future generations to live in. And we are, as I will argue, ill-equipped to deal with what we are doing here in terms of accountability, political control, understanding of these weapon systems. And we've grown a generation of people whom we protected from all of the learning processes that were necessary to understand the awesome power of these weapon systems. But we're committing them to live in a world where they will have them. in a world in which, arguably, I think these weapons will become a means of destabilisation and not stability. So let me make the points that I want to make to you. I said to Michael earlier, he should shut me up when I run over time, as I inevitably will. I'm going to try and pack a lot into a very short period of time. Please resist the temptation to preface your question thereafter by saying you didn't mention this. I'm editing lots of stuff out of this in order to make the point. If you want to extend the conversation, I'm happy to do it, but please don't suggest, you know, I'm surprised that you didn't say something in particular. Both Eric and I could be here for a long time saying things that we all want to say. So let me quickly rush through the points I want to make. So first of all, I'm going to come back here to the United Kingdom. This is what I want to talk about, our contribution to this world that we're creating. So, first of all, the government is replacing the Vanguard submarines. That's what's happening. Right. I mean, we've moved off a decision-making process in which there was going to be some grand decision. This is happening. These boats are being built. We're in the early stages of it, but they are being built. These four Vanguard-class nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines, SSBNs, which have been operational since the 1990s, and are used to carry Trident missiles, which are able to deliver strategic nuclear warheads. Now, people will say, this is not about rebuilding the warheads or the boats, it's only about building the boats, it's just boats. But it's not. This is the bit that we control. The platform is the bit that we control. Release the American missiles. We have a separate warhead which we put together, but broadly we put that together from bits that we buy from the Americans, although we put the intellectual property in a bit that goes bang in the middle. Right. But as you can imagine, since we use a common missile, we can't just screw any old warhead onto the top of it and give it back to them with the threads all gone. It has to be pretty similar to the American warhead, or it won't fit on it. Right. I mean, without getting into the technical details, it's pretty logical. So this is a big decision. And we should move off the idea that there'll be some great parliamentary main gate decision. That's not going to happen any longer. We're going to have a very kind of broad principle discussion about nuclear deterrence. And we're going to have a debate about continuous at-sea deterrence. So we're going to have a debate about the posture and the fact that we should use nuclear weapons, not about the contract. The estimated cost for the construction of these four submarines currently is £31 billion. This is very contentious, but the government's own estimate is £31 billion. That of itself has gone up £6 billion in a very short period of time, and we now have a £10 billion, £10 billion contingency added to it, so it's effectively gone up £16 billion in the blink of an eye. And that has happened without any parliamentary debate, without any parliamentary discussion, without any committee in Parliament saying, how did this happen? What's the justification for this? Why was the estimate so badly off? Why are we doing this? Why do we have a contingency that is one third of the cost of the whole programme? No accountability at all, it just happened, and it's been accepted. The first submarine is estimated to be ready for use. We're now till sometime in the 1930s, but I'll come back to this. And it will remain operational for the next 50 years. So that's until the 2080s or thereabouts. So we are committing ourselves to a significant time. But we're not committing ourselves to anything that makes any difference now or will for the next 10 years. At least 10, maybe 20. In 2007, when I was the Secretary of State for Defence, Parliament made what was then called an initial gate decision, a defence policy, which is essentially we are going to develop this new class of SSBNs. The final decision in the configuration was delayed. It got delayed further again when there was a coalition government and the Liberal Democrats were not willing to have it taken during the time that they were in government. And it has now disappeared. The 2015 Strategic Defence and Security View says the main gate approach is not appropriate for a programme of this scale and complexity. The government has moved to a staged investment programme and it will finalise proposals to begin the next phase focused on, they say, risk reduction and demonstration. That's what they mean about performance of the contract. So this means the government won't contract for the whole submarines. Instead, they will adopt a modular approach, impacting not only on the boats, but the missiles and command and control in other parts. It avoids a main gate decision. It makes it easier for this contract to be changed in the future and maybe even cancelled. And it may well avoid the massive political cost of cancellation, but it will still be big political costs. I have to say that although I am critical of the way in which this was done, I think this is very sensible. I think it's a much more appropriate way to proceed than to make a big decision. I was going to say a big bang decision, but a big decision. And then commit to four boats or three boats in a long-term contract, because I think it is, for reasons that I'll come to, something that we need to keep. We need to keep under review. So today, approximately £4 billion has been spent, and in this Parliament, it is estimated that the government will spend about another £4 billion. So that's eight of the estimated 31 or thereabouts in these two Parliaments, and that figure could be variable depending on probably things like, you know, whether a certain type of metal becomes available at a particular cost, and they may need some of that in the longer term, and they might buy it when they think it's cheap. So this is a major decision in the future defence of the UK. We will bind our security and that of future generations to this system until the 2080s. I don't know if any of you can figure what the 2080s are going to be like. I've very little idea, to be honest. So we should approach this with immense caution. We certainly don't want to be in a position of committing future generations, you know, to dependence and security on a 20th century weapon system in a 21st century world, particularly when the only credible argument for doing that is that this world is going to be uncertain. In other words, we don't know what it's going to be like. And therefore, we don't want to deny future generations the apparent stability that we believe we've had. I pause here to say that it is only ever uncertain to the extent that the uncertainty does not undermine the idea that these weapons will in any way guarantee our security in the future. So if you raise, as I do repeatedly, the possibility of the development of cyber threat to the command and control of these weapons and their efficacy, I am told, you can be certain that that will not happen. If I raise the issue that there is a possibility that drone and other technology for anti-submarine warfare will develop to the point where the sea is no longer opaque, I am told you can be certain that that will not happen. There is always certainty about the things that guarantee the efficacy of nuclear deterrence. But otherwise, there is complete uncertainty, and that justifies us having nuclear deterrence. So, be careful about uncertainty and certainty. The problem that we face is that these decisions are being made in an environment in which the establishment of the United Kingdom, including its Parliament, do not consider these issues to be controversial other than in principle. Our debate here is dominated by moral grounds or whether you are a unilateralist or a multilateralist. And there is little or no detailed scrutiny of the arguments that we should be getting into, such as what is the rationale behind continuous at sea deterrence in an environment in which we say there is no threat? Can we be assured that the impact of evolving anti-submarine warfare and the vulnerability of Trident, the opacity of the sea, is containable? Whether we continue to protect our nuclear threats against evolving cyber threats, or whether we can just be confident that the data that we are being given to instruct these decisions in the first place is reliable against the fact that in almost every single major aspect of it has shifted dramatically without explanation in the last 10 years alone. So why we're not having continuous debates in Parliament, select committee meetings, inquiries, ministers being questioned about all of these aspects is a total, complete and utter mystery to me. But if you want an argument about multilateralism versus unilateralism, then you can have it to your heart's content. And I explained all of these concerns that I have, which I'll quickly summarise for you in a couple of minutes, to a group of MPs recently. And one of them said at the question time, he said, all of this technical stuff is all very interesting. He said, but I just can't make up my mind up whether you're a unilateralist or a multilateralist. And I said, well, I'm kind of here to try and encourage you to do your job. So how about asking the following questions? The key to us having to do this at the moment is, when is the first of these Vanguard boats going to go out of service? So assuming that you put the continuous at sea deterrence argument aside for a moment, and we have to have it, we need boats to do it. So we have to have the first boat come in when the first boat goes out, and they go out and in series. So when I was the Secretary of State for Defence, I was told and accepted and argued that the first boat would go out of service at 2024, and that was a stretch target already. It was possible that we would have to spend a lot of money to keep that boat in service in order to get to 2024. I accepted it, I argued it. I to my constant embarrassment now, I argued with the man who's one of the world's leading nuclear physicists that he was wrong when he said to me that they were good for 10 years anyway, Des. I meet him a lot now and I apologise to him a lot. I went out of government and moved to 2028. I venture to suggest it moved to 2028 to accommodate the Liberal Democrats in government. It moved the main gate decision to 2016. The current position is the first of these boats will go out of service sometime in the 2030s. In 10 years, it's moved. 10 years. None of you will find one line of explanation in a Hansard recording of any debate or any select committee work that explains how that has happened. How has this happened? I mean, do we actually need to replace these boats at all? I am kind of losing confidence in this. It moved 10 years in 10 years, and if it suits the political circumstances, it'll move again. I was told and accepted that the warhead we have would become unsafe and insecure if we didn't replace it. We needed a new warhead at some time, and we had to start planning for it. Because if we need a good lead time to do it, we'd have to start doing it in the next parliament. That was 2010 to 2015. The Americans abandoned their replacement warhead program in 2009. We abandoned ours. No explanation to parliament, no discussion in parliament. Current situation, this is nuclear physics and nuclear engineering, bear in mind. Where would you want people to be precise? The current situation is, in the SSDR, sometime in the next parliament from now, or in the next again parliament, we may need to consider replacing our warhead. We're so precise. There is not one line in a Hansard of any politician asking anybody, how did that happen? You told us that these could become unsafe and insecure. Now we don't need to bother about them for decades. Who do we believe? These are nuclear warheads we're talking about. So I raised cyber threat. Not because I'm a genius, but because the Americans have written a 146-page report about cyber threat to strategic nuclear systems, among other things. I raised developing anti-submarine warfare, not because I'm a genius, but because the chief scientist of NATO said, standing in Norway, after an anti-submarine warfare program, we have defeated the strategic advantage of submarines. We, NATO, have defeated the strategic advantage of submarines by anti-submarine warfare. And I'm told, don't worry about it. We don't need to discuss this. It'll be absolutely fine. And I come here irregularly, no longer an active member of Parliament because I'm on leave from the House of Lords. And I asked people, is it not about time we started asking some questions in Parliament about these things? To satisfy ourselves, we should commit future generations to dependence on this system, which may become a very different system than the one we think we're building. And what do they want to know? Are you a multilateralist or a unilateralist? Mm-hmm.